I have to say, this is quite surreal.
What is?
You know, I'm sitting here in a recording studio with Mary Robinson. You're my former president. It's just a bit like, it's overwhelming. I don't know.
If we're going to do a series together, you're just going to have to get over it.
Right. Okay. You know what? I'm over it.
Right.
I mean, now, I'm not really, but I'm on board.
Look.
Okay.
Right. Now, shall we start the podcast?
Yes, please. No water in the water fountain. Welcome to Mothers of Invention, our brand new podcast where we show that although climate change may be a man-made problem,
it has a wonderfully feminist solution.
I'm Maeve Higgins. I'm a comedian and I'm a writer. I'm Irish, but I live in New York, where I write for the New York Times and host a podcast about immigration.
And my name is Mary Robinson. And when Maeve was 8 years old, I was the president of Ireland. I've since worked for the United Nations as the High Commissioner for Human Rights, which led me into the work that I've been doing for the last 15 years or so, which is climate justice, about the injustice of climate change.
Which basically means that you look at the human issues surrounding climate change rather than the science of it, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. In Mothers of Invention, we're taking a radically different look at the climate challenge ahead of us by shifting the focus onto the women around the world who are doing the most extraordinary work to change their world, and indeed ours.
Yes, those women, they're farmers, teachers, scientists, politicians, stay-at-home mothers, and one thing that they all have in common is that their work takes some of the biggest causes and effects of climate change and finds ways of tackling those effects that are quite simply unprecedented. So why do we say that climate change has a feminist solution?
Because, Maeve, climate change isn't just about statistics and polar bears, although they obviously have their place. As I think we'll see over the next 6 episodes, the things we use and consume, things like money, food, and even plastics, have a huge impact on emissions. What we see time and time again is a major intersection between climate and gender. Almost across the board, women and people from what we're calling the Global South really do suffer most and first from the adverse effects of climate change. And so they're the ones finding the solutions. We're talking about a feminist solution,
yeah.
But feminist doesn't exclude men, as we know.
Yeah.
I think increasingly men like the idea of feminist progressive solutions.
Yeah, the best looking men are feminists, and I don't know which comes first.
You've noticed that, have you?
I don't know if it like makes them hotter that they're feminists or if they're just like so secure in their handsomeness.
Well, we'll leave this now, mate. That's enough.
I'm looking for a scientific answer. It's so true, though, about climate change having a feminist solution.
And it really reflects my own experiences traveling the world. It's women from the Global South, indigenous women, women from minority groups, and women in general who are just rolling up their sleeves and getting on with it.
Yeah, well, look, I'm in a sleeveless tank top and I suppose we better get on with it too.
Yes, Maeve, we better get on with it.
So for our first episode, what are we looking at exactly?
I thought we could start by looking at something that might surprise many people, and that's the fact that one of the most powerful tools climate activists have is lawyers, or more specifically, litigation.
Okay, so that is really interesting. And you were a lawyer before you became president of Ireland, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. But I took the jobs that interested me, the ones that were about issues that the law could bring about a social change. Bringing the conversation to 2018, where we are now, we have the targets put in place by the Paris Agreement in 2015.
I know now that that means 195 nations agreed to do everything in their power not to let global temperatures rise to 1.5 degrees above what they were in the pre-industrial age.
And achieving what we call net zero carbon emissions, which means bring our carbon emissions down and then plant more trees and have more afforestation to absorb the carbon dioxide.
Right, right. And that's a really clear target by 2050.
That's yes. Right. But crucially, not a fully legally enforceable one, which means that for many environmental groups and activists, there's a lack of proper accountability. And that problem happens to be a big opportunity, as today's episode will reveal. Luckily, we have somebody with us who can tell us a lot more. Tessa Kahn, co-director of the Climate Litigation Network.
What's your job title exactly?
That's a good question. I refer to myself as a climate change and human rights lawyer.
So when did that start in your brain?
I think it's always been quite obvious to me that that's broadly speaking what I have wanted to do. My family's from Bangladesh. I grew up in Australia and living in both Bangladesh and Australia and seeing the vast inequalities and not really being able to wrap my head around why it was. It's ironic that I'm connected to both Bangladesh and Australia, both of which in their own ways are incredibly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. But on the one hand, Australia is an extremely wealthy country with the resources to address the problem, and it has the highest per capita emissions of any developed country. And then on the other hand, in Bangladesh, of course, it's so affected by climate change. And the average Bangladeshi's carbon footprint is something like 1/40th of, you know, the average American's. For me, that is the central injustice of climate change, that those people who have contributed least to it are suffering its impacts and have the fewest resources to adapt. We're all entitled to human rights. There are people who are responsible for delivering on those rights, and the law is a really powerful tool for doing that.
Could you break down for us like the types of litigation that are out there that are available to people?
So I think broadly speaking, climate change litigation targets governments and companies. Or we've had cases that ask governments to take more steps to help people to adapt to climate change. A case in 2015 was brought by a Pakistani farmer against the Pakistani government. He claimed that the government's failure to implement measures to help people in Pakistan adapt to climate change was a violation of his human rights and his dignity. And the court found in his favour, and they ordered the government to implement its national climate change policy, the measures that it had set out but had done nothing to really affect. And it also set up a body to supervise the implementation of those measures.
And he was one man.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary impact that that case has had.
I think it's time for us to meet Marianne Minesma. About 5 years ago, she was working for an environmental NGO in the Netherlands, where she still lives now.
I'm the director and founder of Urgenda.
Urgenda is an NGO that tries to bypass government inaction to get people to live more sustainably.
In the Netherlands, we act very often as a progressive country, and with our mouth, we are very good in being front runner. But if you look at what we really do, we are not so progressive. After 40 books of all kinds of PhD students, I thought, well, very nice, but what are we changing in the real world? If we go on until 2050 like this, many of the things we have now will be lost. We have a kind of think tank, and there was a lawyer in the think tank that had written a book, and it said, climate change is a big problem. I agreed. The Dutch government, or most governments, are not doing what's necessary. And he had concluded, there's only one democratic way that we still have not used, and that is law.
Urgenda decided to sue the Dutch government. They wanted the government to commit to reducing emissions by 2020.
We wanted to do this with as many people as possible. So we invited basically everybody and said, we will run the court case. You don't have to pay anything, but we would like co-plaintiffs.
Marianne knew she'd have some supporters, but after advertising the lawsuit, she suddenly found herself with 886 co-plaintiffs.
We had from astronauts to school teachers. It's not one typical type of person.
I'm Joos Okkels, and I live in Amsterdam. I am the wife of the late Wubbo Okkels, Holland's first astronaut. He flew on the Challenger in 1986. When he came back from space, he had many stories, mostly about the beauty and vulnerability of our planet Earth. He said, we are not made for space or for another planet. We are made for this planet. You don't see any other planet where you ever could go to.
My name is Chihiro Heusenbroek. I'm a Dutch-Bolivian filmmaker. There's always this feeling that we're living in a very dissonant way with nature. Being at the back of my mother's bike and going over the bumps in the road because of roots of trees that would grow up. And I'd be like, there's nothing natural about these tree roots being under this cement. When I went to university, I met other people and had an entry into a collective way of voicing that concern. The thing that really resonated with me about the court case was that it had never been done.
We already were in the mood that it was really necessary to do everything And we supported Marianne in that. But our expectations were not that you could easily win that. It would be difficult.
It was the first time a government had been sued for climate liability by its own citizens. But would it work?
There was still a lot of speculation, like it will be overruled. Maybe they're guilty, but they're not accountable. So then it will not see court. The moment it actually went into court, it became more exciting and it started looking like, hey, this is really happening.
The government argued that such a drastic reduction in such a short period of time would have a negative effect on the economy and therefore on society. Urgenda's lawyers presented scientific evidence on how climate change would affect the Netherlands. After the arguments were heard, the verdict date was set for a couple of months after, and everyone knew that the verdict had the power to change the world.
On the 21st of June 2015, the court was giving its verdict.
Hundreds of the co-plaintiffs decided to go to The Hague to hear it for themselves.
The courthouse was not prepared for that, so they had to arrange for overflow rooms with screens so we could see. There's press, and it was very tense. We were really instructed to be quiet because there were a lot of cameras in the room. I remember sitting next to a friend who was also a co-plaintiff. I remember squeezing hands. We needed a judge not only to listen to the facts, but also to have the courage to do something that has never been done.
I heard in the very last moment, it was in two languages. I thought, whoa, maybe it will be positive then. In the first sentences, he was like, well, climate change is a very big problem. And I was twittering, yeah, that's already a big win. If a judge says it's a big problem, great. I think he's going to give us what we want. And then I stopped twittering. I was like, whoa. And then he said at this very end, 25% in 2020.
Het berusten in een geringere reductie is onrechtmatig tegenover Urgenda.
And everyone was like, wah! Marianne Minnesma, she raised up her hand, just fist in the air type of thing, because we all were instructed to be quiet.
Well, that was emotional.
Urgenda had won. The court ruled that the government had an obligation to protect its citizens and to reduce its emissions by 25% above the 1990 standards by the year 2020.
Within half an hour, the whole world would know it. I was surprised how quickly that went.
There was a lot of surprise. On the one hand, there was joy, and people also experienced it like the movement for sustainability has grown up.
In the meantime, the Dutch government have appealed, and it doesn't matter how long the appeal and maybe the next step thereafter will take. If we win, it will be by the end of 2020, 25%. If they lose, and then the Dutch government need to make the change, it will be very difficult and very costly.
I think the biggest impact that the case had was in our collective boldness. Now we're moving the bar again with the next court case, holding Shell accountable for producing 2% of all global emissions since Industrial Revolution.
I did not imagine what it would spark off. There's many things that you don't think of when you start. You just think it's possible and let's start a court case. But it's so much more than just a court case.
If I was walking with Wibble on the streets, there were always people who stopped him and said, oh, tell me, and you know. And then he says, well, look up to this wonderful blue sky. You think it goes on forever. It's endless. And he says, that's the trick. If you look from the other side, you see, it is so terribly thin. And it's all we have which protects us. So don't play poker with our atmosphere and put all kinds of stuff in it which does not belong there. That's it.
Such an incredible example of people power and people making their governments work for them.
Absolutely. So this case really set a precedent in more ways than one. You heard Chichiro say that there's a similar class action lawsuit going on now with Dutch citizens suing Shell.
Yeah.
And the Shell case is a bit different because Shell's a company, not a country. Mm-hmm. But the same lawyer is heading it up. And since April, they've had more than 10,000 co-plaintiffs sign up.
Wow.
That goes to court in December, I believe. Mm-hmm. And in October, the court will give a decision on the Dutch government's appeal in the Urgenda case. And I really hope that it will be upheld. Other countries are suing their governments now. You know, you'd be perhaps surprised to know. I mean, how many cases do you think? How many climate litigation cases would there be?
I think
possibly mentioned, did I?
I remember two numbers. I remember the number 300 and I remember the number 1,000.
Which do you think it is?
I think it's probably 300.
Well, you're wrong.
Oh, really?
I'm glad to
say.
Oh,
really?
So, that's okay.
Oh.
Thank goodness. It's about 1,000 now. And Tessa, you're the self-professed proud member of Team Urgenda. So tell us about that.
Basically, my reaction to the Urgenda case and hearing about the victory was to more or less cold call one of the Dutch lawyers in the team, Dennis van Berkel. I sent him an email and I basically offered to quit my job at the time, which was an incredibly rewarding job. And I had a very nice life in Northern Thailand. But I offered to give all of that up if he thought it was worthwhile establishing a project or an organization that worked with lawyers and campaigners in different countries to try to replicate what the Dutch team had achieved in the Netherlands. And to my huge surprise and great fortune, he agreed after one Skype call that that would be a good way to go. And so for the last 2 years, he and I have been working together to partner with lawyers in a number of different countries around the world.
And that's where the world focus is.
Exactly.
Implementing their nationally determined contributions, but also reducing the emissions to mean that the world will be on a pathway well below 2 degrees, working for 1.5. We're not on course for that. What can the national courts do? How can we get litigation to fill that gap?
Most legal systems have laws embedded within them that create duties for governments to protect citizens. Those are human rights laws, or in the Urgenda case, it was a civil law that basically says that governments have a duty of care. These laws exist in different forms in almost every country in the world, and we can use them to really enforce those promises and the commitments that governments have made.
Without the laws, it makes me think of, I won't eat sugar tomorrow or next week, but then nothing is making me do that unless I like throw out the sugar and write it down. And without that, aspirationally, I'm at the Olympics. But in reality, I'm just in bed. Could you talk to us about people power and how that helps your work as a lawyer?
I really believe that litigation is only ever as powerful as the movement that's behind it. And my experience working in human rights has been that social movements are what matter and really what affect change. The civil rights movement is a very good example of the way that strategic litigation can only go so far. You had a very important Supreme Court judgment that said that schools had to desegregate, but there was no appetite to enforce that judgment at a political level. And it was only when there was a lot of noise at a community level and the federal government took notice and sent in the National Guard to escort children who were walking into desegregated schools, it was only then that there was actual accountability for that order. And it's illustrative of how important it is for people to come together to demand change, to agitate, to hold people accountable, to model on an individual level what they want their society to look like. When you have that, that's when governments start to really feel the heat.
Something that concerns me, the global women's movement. We're talking about discrimination, we're talking about economic empowerment. We get quickly onto health, onto education, and climate is way down the list. Why can we not make that connection more, and how do we make that connection?
My experience has been a bit different, actually. Working in Asia with the women's movement, climate change is very much part of the agenda. Mm-hmm. Climate change is a feminist issue, particularly in developing countries where they rely more on the land for their livelihoods. In natural disasters, they're more likely to die than men, and they have the responsibility for providing for their families. So they experience the stress of climate change in a totally disproportionate way. But I think it's also really important to say, when we're talking about the way that women are affected in climate change, that they're also some of the most important agents of change.
Exactly.
They're not just victims, but because of their relationship and their responsibilities in relation to the land and natural resources, they have the solutions. And women are at the forefront of creating decentralized energy networks, you know, and community ownership over natural resources that provide resilience.
Could I ask you about the role of race in climate litigation? You talked already about how Bangladesh is one of the worst affected countries but doesn't have the resources that a wealthier country would. It makes me think, well, most people in Bangladesh are brown, most people in Australia are white. So could you speak to that at all?
It's a tough one because I think, as Mary mentioned earlier, there is an increasing willingness on the part of high-level kind of climate discussions to incorporate those grassroots voices to ultimately make sure that our actions respond to the priorities of the people who are most affected. And you can only do that when you're listening to the people who are most affected. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's always a risk of sort of instrumentalization of people's mm-hmm. experiences, of sort of rolling them out in a slightly tokenistic way without a genuine commitment to partnership and agency. The lawyers may come from privileged communities, mm-hmm. and unfortunately at the moment, especially in developed countries, that's mm-hmm. how it tends to be. But we need to let those people who are really affected be in the driving seat of how we present these cases publicly.
That actually seems like a really good time for us to go into our second story. And it's one I don't think has had quite as much attention as it deserves. But by the time October comes round, I think we'll all know a bit more about it. So let's meet the kids who are suing Trump over climate change.
My name is Kelsey Cascadia Rose Juliana. I'm 22 years old. I live in Eugene, Oregon. And when I was 14 years old, I co-filed a lawsuit against the governor of Oregon. Then when I was 19 years old, I sued the federal government. My first kind of real engagement with climate change was when I was 10. We dressed up as cheerleaders and went to the local football game on ESPN Day, and we got thousands and thousands of people to walk by and listen to us chant, "Stop global warming or we're all dead ducks." There's 21 young people from across this nation who feel strongly enough that, yes, this issue of climate devastation is important to them. Yes, they're feeling the harms right now from climate change. And yes, they want to represent their voices, but also their peers' voices and future generations' voices in front of government through the courts.
Kelsey's been with us a long time and has become an inspiration for many other young people, especially young girls who tremendously look up to her. My name is Julia Olson. I am co-lead counsel in the case Juliana versus the United States, 21 young people suing the United States government. I met Kelsey in early 2011, and she became one of our first plaintiffs in the case against the state of Oregon. Back in 2006, it was summertime, I was 8 months pregnant, and I watched An Inconvenient Truth in the movie theaters and ended up just crying, sobbing through the whole film. I really started thinking as a legal community, we didn't really have a proactive strategy to try to solve climate change. I had this notion that many lawyers around the country should bring cases outside of the environmental statutory context and really try to push the ball and get governments acting on climate change. From there, everything went on super mode, founding our Children's Trust, mobilizing lawyers, and on Mother's Day week in May of 2011, we launched 50 actions on behalf of young people all across the country in every state and against the federal government.
My name is Vic Barrett. I'm 19 years old. I'm from New York, and I'm a plaintiff on the Our Children's Trust lawsuit. Our Children's Trust contacted me after learning about some of the activism I was doing in New York City to try to get climate education in public schools and try to get offshore wind implemented. I was 16. My whole life, I've just been in boxes of people that aren't listened to, like Black, Latinx, femme, queer. But fact is, as a young activist, I couldn't vote for most of the activism that I was doing. That means that council members and legislators had no vested interest in listening to me. There had to be another route that I could take so that I could put the actual climate facts in front of politicians and have them have to address it. Basically, the lawsuit is a litigation put up against the U.S. federal government stating that they're violating young people's rights to life, liberty, and property by allowing for the development and excessive use of fossil fuels in the United States and around the world, contributing massively to global climate change. We're suing them saying they're violating our constitutional rights, the Fifth and Ninth Amendment, and also violating the public trust by using public lands to harm the earth.
Jojo! This is some of our honey. No, Oh yeah, I think that is. We use up some of our other honey. But then we have kombucha. As someone who's a young person and has tried engaging in government under the voting age, and then as someone who's also voted now that I'm 22, I see this case as being an incredible opportunity for young people to feel empowered and to be represented in front of their government, utilizing the court systems.
From the beginning of this country, many of the biggest constitutional cases had plaintiffs selected by lawyers because they were emblematic of the issue that the attorneys wanted to take up to the courts. I don't like the idea of parents or adults pushing children into activism or some political statement that is not coming from within them. It's very important to me that children who come and work with us and become plaintiffs do it because they want to and they are not being pressured in any way. So these kids are deeply, deeply invested. Some of them have to convince their parents to let them do it because the parents don't understand or are a little wary of their children getting involved in a lawsuit.
My parents were pretty nervous about it, to be honest. They have their own activism past and they're very experienced. I know a lot about what it means to do this work. I think they were kind of nervous for me to engage in this legal work as an eighth grader. But I was very, very strong in my desire to do this. Victoria and I are co-plaintiffs. I think Victoria's story is incredible. I've come from a very supportive background. I grew up in this circle of like-minded people and supportive communities. Victoria is a very different story.
When I was first explaining the lawsuit to my mom, because I was under 18, so I couldn't do that without their permission. At first, she was kind of skeptical. She was like, "Are you really interested in suing the government when that's who you want to work for in the future?" She's from Honduras, where government relationships with civilians is not the same. You don't sue the government in Honduras. That's not a safe thing to do. My dad is a Republican, and he doesn't necessarily believe that climate change is that big of a deal. At the end of the day, he was just really proud of me for stepping up and doing something in a society that he thinks is really complacent, whether it's something he agreed with or not. Environmentalists for a long time have mostly been white, college-educated people who get the resources to learn about this issue. But fact is, the person in the South Bronx is suffering from ridiculously high asthma rates in their community, and the person who went to that university is most likely just reading about it in a textbook. That's why we need people who are actually living these issues and existing in these places to be the ones given the biggest platforms to discuss it, because they're the ones who are actively feeling the impacts in their everyday lives.
One of the things that really inspires me is the civil rights movement. We have not even come close to being totally successful in desegregation and in eliminating racism, but the country is vastly different today than it was in 1954. That to me is incredible. It took a handful of people who stood up and did something different. So you never know who it's going to be or what action it will take before you have a huge shift.
Young people are becoming leaders of these different issues. If we just even look at the recent example of school shooting and young people taking on this issue and how far we've gotten from young people owning this issue and demanding change from their voices, from their ideas, from their visions. The young people are taking stands for issues that matter to them. And in terms of climate change, we are disproportionately affected.
We go to trial on October 29th, 2018. It will be about an 8 to 10 week trial in the federal courthouse in Eugene, Oregon, in front of Judge Ann Aiken. What's at stake is really whether people in this country hold fundamental constitutional rights to have a climate system that is not destroyed by fossil fuel pollution.
I genuinely am optimistic that our government will listen to us and hear our demands. I'm optimistic because so far, that's exactly what they've been doing.
These generations that are in office, what don't they understand about the urgency of climate change? I'm 19 years old. I have a good few more decades on this planet, and the projections for the later ends of those decades aren't really a planet that I'm interested in living on or interested in raising kids in.
And so we need to be doing this work in the courts, but we also need to be in the streets. And so on the first day of trial, we're helping to organize rallies across the country and even globally at federal courthouses or other places of justice where people will be in the streets standing in solidarity with these 21 youth as they go to trial.
So if we win the trial, the U.S. federal government would have to institute a climate recovery plan based on scientific data. When I go to Honduras, I see the sea level rise. I see the climate impacts right there. My family's house is right on the water. And it really just pointed out to me that people who look like me all around the world are being disproportionately impacted. That is inherently unfair. And that's why I knew that climate change and climate justice was something that I had to involve myself in.
I've gotten to go to Norway and to Philippines to represent this case and talk about climate work. In those places, they've actually been inspired by our climate work centered out of Eugene from Our Children's Trust. And there are now cases in Pakistan and India and Philippines and Bangladesh and Canada inspired by what we're doing here in Eugene.
Please leave your message.
My name is Sarah Thompson. I live in Auckland in New Zealand. I was 24 when I filed judicial review proceedings against the New Zealand government. When I first heard about the Juliana versus the US case, my reaction was, oh my God, these young people are genius. Courage is contagious, and when you see other people dedicated to fighting for a cause, it's hard not to be inspired by that.
My full name is Rabab Ali Ghazi. I am 10 years old and I live in Karachi, Pakistan. In Karachi, the pollution level is very high. It directly affects IQ level of kids. Our government are responsible and they must be sued.
Mi nombre es Carmen Rosales, tengo 22 años, soy de Cartagena de Indias.
Hola, me llamo Aymara Cueva Ramírez. Tengo 9 años.
My name is Gabriela Eslava. I'm a 26-year-old lawyer from Bogotá, Colombia, and I'm one of the plaintiffs of the first Future Generations lawsuit in Latin America.
The Colombian case started because we wanted to stop complaining about climate change.
My name is Ridhima Pandey, and I'm 11 years old. I live in India, in Uttarakhand, in Haridwar. I decided to sue my government because our government is not taking global warming seriously. So in future, we children have to face lots of problems like floods, disasters. That's why I sue my government. I hope that our court will be in our favor. And for the other children, I'll keep my finger crossed.
You know, I'm not going to blame older generations. And quite frankly, it's one of my biggest pet peeves is when I hear older generations blaming themselves and saying, well, we're their hope. And to me, I'm not going to tolerate that. You can blame your past generations, but if you are able to see their wrongdoings, see their mistakes, and be hopeful in the work that I'm doing and my cohorts are doing, then you should join us too. Be an active participant. Have active hope in this.
Wow.
Where were you at 15 and what were you thinking about?
certainly not suing the government. Mm. That took another 20 years or so. But one of the sort of formative experiences for me as a 15-year-old were watching debaters in the state-level debating team and just thinking they were celebrities. Just I really thought that how articulate they were was so powerful. It really switched me on to the power of persuasion.
Could I ask about your own debating?
this sounds like a setup.
Did you then become a debater?
I did, yes. Such was the level of inspiration of watching those other young people. So I was subsequently chosen to compete at a state level and then a national level and then an international level. I was on the Australian schools debating team and we won the world championships in 1999. So that was a level of glory my career's never returned to. Which checks the what is your career highlight question that was coming.
It was
coming,
all downhill from there.
Exactly, pretty much.
To be honest, when I was 15, I did have a sense of social justice, but I didn't know where to put it. I used to write these really long, like overly personal letters to political prisoners in East Timor. where I would be like, I wasn't allowed to go to the Smashing Pumpkins concert. I too know injustice. So I think it was quite misguided. But what were you doing when you were 15? Do you remember?
Well, I was in boarding school, focused on hockey and various important things like that. But I did have this strong inner sense. Mm-hmm. I think it came from being wedged between four brothers, two older than me and two younger than me. So, of course, I had to be interested in equality and human rights. And that, you know, and I do remember at the age of about 15, reading about Eleanor Roosevelt and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it was a light bulb to me, and that it was a woman.
It's important to remember that while, of course, future generations, because of the incredibly uncertain future we're assigning to them, will be the ones who will deal with the worst impact, but that's not to say that we're not feeling the impact right now. And in fact, there was a case brought on behalf of about 800 elderly women in Switzerland. It was a climate change case as well, challenging the Swiss government's climate change policy on the basis that elderly women are actually among the most vulnerable to a disrupted climate.
In Switzerland?
Like, to things like heat waves.
That reminds me, when the climate summit took place in New York in September 2014, it was preceded, as you recall, by a huge climate march. About 400,000 people got out into the streets of New York. And I was there as an elder with Gro Harlem Brundtland. And I saw a placard a little bit away that I really wanted to join, which was Angry Grannies. So the Angry Grannies in Switzerland obviously did something.
They're going to court.
Wow. Yeah. I like it.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, and that's a human rights case as well. You know, they're saying climate change is a threat to them as it's a threat to all of us. And I think that's the other way in which climate change has the potential for building a massive movement, because it's not just about environmentalists.
Are environmentalists finding fierce opposition to their own cases?
The fossil fuel industry is incredibly wealthy and very powerful, and it's done a good job of creating a narrative around the fact that we need energy and they're the only source of energy. And then on the other hand, in a slightly more below the belt way, they've been really actively targeting environmental activists and defenders. There's a long history of corporate harassment of people working to defend their rights. There's a particular brand of harassment known as slap suits, strategic lawsuits against public participation. They are designed to effectively use the courts to harass, intimidate, and waste the time of environmental defenders. And it's been quite effective in the past. For example, there was a Swedish documentary filmmaker who made a film about the impacts of pesticide use by a big banana company, Dole Bananas, mm-hmm. on Nicaraguan banana farmers. Mm-hmm. And that company sued this documentary filmmaker for defamation, and film festivals refused to show his film because they were afraid of the legal implications of doing that.
It sounds so petty. Imagine going to law school and then using your powers to sue a filmmaker who made a film about Nicaraguan banana.
You could be well paid for that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Mary's eyes are lighting up over there.
No. I'm disgusted.
Yeah.
What cases are you helping now, supporting lawyers?
I think one of the most important cases that we're currently working on is actually against the government of Ireland. Unknown to a lot of people, Ireland is one of the worst climate performers within Europe. It has the third highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions of any EU country. Its emissions are rising and are projected to increase by 2020 and again by 2030.
As a former president, I don't speak out on these issues, but I can quote what the Irish Prime Minister Taoiseach said, that we are a laggard, which is not a good place to be on climate change.
We're in a studio a few steps away from them, really. Do you want to visit after this?
I think I should probably keep a low profile while I'm here, although we're very much in the background. In that case, the heavy lifting is 100% being done by an Irish legal team and a very brave plaintiff network.
I have a proof that attitudes have changed in Ireland. Mm-hmm. I had a terrible time from taxi drivers when I started working on climate.
Did you?
Oh, that's nonsense. No, not a thing. Now they're my greatest allies. They all want electric cars and they want more support to be able to have electric
cars.
Amazing. Yeah. Yep.
That's so wonderful. When we went for drinks and afterwards, Mary got into a cab and this man kind of lurched past and said, "Oh, my president." She was getting into the car. She waved very kindly. And I thought, well, that taxi man, if he didn't know, now he knows. That's cool to hear that, though.
Yeah, it's very true. I haven't been in a taxi with a taxi driver who hasn't been supportive. And I raise it every time. It's my little contribution to...
Instead of a tip. Here's a tip for your future, babe.
This seems to be quite a hopeful time. I mean, we have the Me Too movement. We have young people coming out against guns because of the terrible school tragedies in the United States. You get the real sense that people are realising we've got to get out there and do something. How can we make that a Me Too for climate?
I actually think that these cases are a really important tool for connecting with people about the problem of climate change, because people can be a bit overwhelmed sometimes, and also by the idea that we as individuals can possibly affect a change. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really diffuse sense of responsibility around climate change. I think litigation creates a narrative that connects with people on a moral level that's quite powerful for engaging people around climate change.
So we have a job to do.
Yes, exactly. Oh, there is so much work to do. Good thing this job pays so well.
Well, Tessa Khan, thank you so much for such an enlightening and wonderful conversation today.
Oh, it's been a privilege. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, not at all.
No, it's been really great. And I can't believe how similar our approach is as human rights lawyers addressing now climate change. Neither of us having really worked in environmental law as such, that encourages me a lot, because there's such a nexus between human rights and climate change. And supporting litigation, I think, is a great way to do it and a great way to tell the stories. So
get a room, you guys. Jeez, I'm right here.
Career highlight, two in one morning.
We're going to stay in touch.
Yes, please. I would love that.
So that's it for today. We've come to the end of our very first episode. Well done to us, Mary.
Yes, not bad at all, given that this is my first time actually recording a podcast.
No, I think it was really great. I mean, we can do a performance review if you want.
I don't think that would be necessary, if you don't mind, Maeve.
Okay, so we've been to the Netherlands, to the States, and found out just how little money there is in being a climate justice lawyer.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with our second episode.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thanks for listening and see you then. Find out more about the series, the mothers we've met today, and support them at mothersofinvention.online. Follow us for updates on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society and recorded in Dublin, London, and New York.
This episode of Mothers of Invention was made possible by the Compton Foundation.
Our head counsel and series producer is Lena Prestwood. And the courtroom clerk and producer was Dara Kell.
With assistant producer Laura Hyde.
Jurors and researchers have been Rhiannon Licorice, Aisha Yunus. Our judges and executive producers are Jess Search and BD Finzi. Our barrister and editor is Samuel Shelton Robinson. This episode was witnessed and mixed by James McKee.
Our title music is Water Fountain by Tune Yards. Additional music composed by Dan Wilson, Kalu and Poddington Bear.
Our stories were made by our renegade lawyers, producers, Anik C in the Netherlands and Maya Croth in the USA. Our impact producer is Hazel Falk.
Our courtroom interpreters and consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, Catherine Wilkinson and Suzanne Dhaliwal.